The guest has arrived. The host is prepped and ready. Ladies and gentlemen, this is One-on-One with Bill Alexander.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the show. Bill Alexander with you. Great to have you joining us today. And on the other end of the screen, we're actually talking to someone that we talked to, a few months back. And what's interesting about it, it was one of the most viewed videos on YouTube that I've had in a long time. 11,000 views, which to me is amazing. But I think the reason is this woman has a message to tell and everybody wants to hear it. On the other end, I have Victoria Valentino. Victoria, how are you doing today?
Well, I'm doing fine. Welcome to my closet. Well, and hopefully the dogs won't bark.
Well, thank you for having me in your closet today. But the reason I had you come back on again is because we did not touch on the subject that we're about to talk about today, because we were talking about your career in Playboy and everything after that. But one situation that happened while you were with Playboy is that you were attacked by Bill Cosby, and you were one of the women who actually came out against him when this whole trial situation happened. And I did not realize until right now that he was released last June from the prison. And it's just one of those situations that is just mind-boggling how he could be released. But again, a lot of people don't see him the way you and other accusers see him.
That's because they weren't alone in a room with him.
Right.
With pills on board that he had managed to get you to take.
So yeah. You had no idea what was going on. It's just that he was there and you had no control over the situation because you didn't realize what was going on.
Well, it's a little bit more complicated than that. After my little boy drowned at a week and a half after his sixth birthday in the swimming pool of my music attorney, who was giving a party to celebrate the successful negotiation of my recording contract with Capitol Records, I was kind of derailed. For a period of time, my grandmother, my great aunt, my favorite uncle, my other favorite auntie, everybody died, including the babysitter having a heart attack in my garage
The
neighbor's dog killing my son's guinea pig and rabbit. So it was a death cluster. I was 26 and I had never even been to a funeral. And the only dead bodies I had ever seen were, you know, the random birds and mice
right.
The cat brought in, which I, of course, as a little girl, always buried very ceremoniously and put flowers on top of the grave and knelt and prayed over them. And so it was a huge shock. And I was really an altered state for a long time after that. So I was living with my bunny trainer, Fran Emerson, who had reached out to me because my parents were not particularly compassionate and blamed me for my son's death. And so she reached out and said, come stay with me in Laurel Canyon, which is right off the Sunset Boulevard, you know, the beginning of the Sunset Strip.
Okay.
And I was living on my advance money from Capitol Records for my album. And I was beginning to run out of money and I was picking up little, you know, parts here and there, you know, in movies. I picked up some kind of part. I can't even remember what it was. I was going around as if I was underwater for a long time after my son died. People were steering me around by the elbow, driving me because I was not capable of driving for a period of time and too distracted. And so anyway, Fran said, hey, I know Bill Cosby. He used to play, like all of the other comedians, the Playboy Club circuit.
Right.
And she used to work the living room of the club. I worked the Playmate bar. She worked the living room back when we were both working the club. This is after the club, after we were working the club. The club was still going on. But so she knew all the comedians and everybody. And she said, he's doing this show and I can get you an interview. I thought it was I Spy because when I would go over to my parents' house, they would watch it. And after my son died, of course, I wasn't watching TV or paying attention to anybody's career, not right. even my own. So I didn't know exactly what show he was playing in, but I thought, well, maybe I can't go into the studio and record because I'd pretty much lost my music after my son died.
Right.
But I can parrot somebody else's lines or do background or whatever. I just need a job to keep food in my mouth.
Right.
So she arranged an interview with Cosby, and I thought it was an audition, but when I got to the studio, it was actually in his trailer on the lot. And as I was going out the door, she handed me my son's 8x10, and it was a beautiful picture of him looking directly into the camera, black and white, headshot, with his little 60s afro. He was biracial. And she said, take this picture and show it to Kaz, you know, and tell him your story. And so I did. And I sat there in his trailer, and he sat across from me holding the picture. And he was mesmerized. He just kept looking at it and looking at it and looking at it. I mean, it was a very powerful shot, you know, this little boy directly looking at you
right.
through the photograph, probably still has his fingerprints on it. Cosby's fingerprints. So as I often do when I'm under stress, I talk more and talk faster. And he was very silent, staring at this picture, holding the 8x10 in his hands. And I kept thinking, well, I'm sounding more and more like an emotional basket case. This guy is not going to give me an audition. You know, he's not going to trust me to be sane on his set, obviously. So after a certain period of time, nothing was progressing. So I just stood up abruptly and took the photograph and said, well, thank you very much. And I exited. Mm-hmm. Never expecting to hear from him, never expecting to see him again. And I didn't until after I moved from France. I moved into my grandma's house. She had just died and my mom was renting the house. So she let me and an interim boyfriend and this other couple who were friends of his move into the house and rent the house in West Hollywood.
Okay.
And it was a California bungalow that my great-great uncle had built way back in the early 1900s.
Now, I have a question for you because I'm remembering the first interview.
Yeah.
You left there because you were having it. You left to go there originally because you were having issues with your parents.
Yes.
Okay. Okay. So I remember everything now because we talked about that.
Yeah. Yeah. For a while, I couldn't go into my own house because I couldn't look at my son's bedroom. Right. So I was sleeping on the sofa of my neighbors across the street. And then I was back and forth between there and my mom's house. And then Fran just said, you know what? I see what's going on here. My mother was, what are you crying for? You know, right. Well, my son just died. And, you know, so anyway, so that's how I wound up at Fran's. And then I went to my grandma's house, which was, you know, I mean, they were all just sort of within a half mile of each other, everything. And so, so I was there, and my roommate, this actress, her name was Meg, and she liked to go over to the Cafe Figaro over on Doheny and Melrose, which was the dividing line between West Hollywood and Beverly Hills. And I was delighted to go because when I was a student in New York, the Cafe Figaro, the original one, was in Greenwich Village, and I used to do my homework there and watch Laurel and Hardy movies and stuff. They had a big screen. And so I went with her, and this particular day, I was sitting there just grief-stricken beyond words. You know, when you lose a child, it's not just like an emotional boo-hoo. It's like a horse kicked you in the gut. You know, it's a very visceral kind of pain, and it comes in waves, and you can't predict it, and you can't do anything about it except basically try to survive it. And so I really kind of didn't want to go, but by that time I was driving, and I had my car, and she didn't have a car, so I wound up being recruited to do the driving. And we went over there, and we could have a bowl of French onion soup, a basket of warm bread, and we scraped our pennies together for a half a carafe of red wine, which we shared. So this one day, I was just sitting there crying into my onion soup, and just convulsively, I just couldn't stop crying. And all of a sudden, this man I saw standing at the edge of our table, and I realized it was Cosby. At the time, I didn't know that he was part owner of the Cafe Figaro. I learned much later, years later, in fact. So she had these eyes that were like a Malamute, like an Alaskan husky, you know, these white blue eyes that were absolutely mesmerizing. Everybody who came in contact with her never forgot her eyes. She had a story about a boyfriend in New York calling, and we were at this vegetarian restaurant in Hollywood, and he told the waiter, he said, look for the eyes, you know, to give her a message. And of course he found her right away.
Right.
So those were the kind of eyes she had. And what I have since learned since I've gone public about Cosby is that eyes were one of his fetishes.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And so he, knowing my story already from the interview in his trailer, knew that I was a mess emotionally, and he wanted to get to her. So he used my grief to act compassionate when he was chatting her up and said, well, you know, Vicky, which is what everybody called me in those days, which I hate actually, but he said, you know, she really needs something, you know, some nurturing. And he said, he put her in charge of me.
Okay.
And said, I'm going to treat you girls to this spa down on Santa Monica Boulevard, a Finnish steam bath and a massage. And he gave her his private number. And he said, when you're done, give me a call, and I'll send my driver over to your grandma's house and pick you up, and I'll treat you to dinner. It'll do Vicky good. So that was how that came about.
Okay.
So we wound up at a steakhouse on the Sunset Strip right next to the Whiskey a Go-Go. It's not there anymore. There's another restaurant, but that's the way it is in Hollywood.
Right.
Restaurants come and go. And so we were there sitting in kind of a banquette style, he was to her left and she was to my left. So I was the tag along. And he ordered wine, and I don't know what I ordered, but I wasn't hungry. And he was busy chatting her up and trying to entertain us with mush mouth kind of jokey stuff. And I wasn't interested, but I was there.
Right.
And knew I was just sort of the tag along. And I knew that I was the excuse for him to connect with her. And so I was sitting there kind of rearranging the food on my plate, not really paying attention to them. And I guess that bothered him. And he reached across my plate and put a pill next to my wine glass. And he said, "Here, take this. It'll make you feel better. It'll make us all feel better." And then he put a pill next to her glass. And then he acted like he was going to take a pill.
Right.
And then shortly thereafter, he reached across and put another pill directly in my mouth, same to her. And I guess I thought, well, you know, initially, I think I must have thought it was an upper, because everybody in those days, all the managers of clubs, everybody was giving you diet pills to keep your weight down so that you would fit in the bunny costumes. They were giving you uppers so that you could work longer shifts and still be perky, you know. So it was kind of a standard thing. And I don't think any of us initially realized they were addictive. They were just diet pills, and the doctors gave them to us. They gave them along with diuretics to get rid of the water weight.
Right.
And birth control pills. And birth control pills in those days had pretty much just been invented, and they had a whole lot of estrogen in them. And so they made us blow up. Mm-hmm. So we were always at risk of being too fat for the bunny costumes, and we didn't want to lose our jobs.
Right.
So this trilogy of medications was always part of our everyday life. Except we started having electrolyte imbalances and getting weird, you know, and falling apart and emotionally and, you know, fainting and on in the service bar and stuff like that, not understanding what was going on. Now, as a registered nurse, of course, I understand how devastating that combination is. But anyway, so I think I figured if I wanted to feel better and if he wanted me to be perky, it was just another diet pill.
Right.
So I knew the reaction that I had to those. So I thought, okay, so I took it. Unfortunately, pretty soon my face was in the plate and so was hers. And I remember saying, "I want to go home." And he said, "Oh, okay. Sure, you know."
Right.
And
right.
We went back up the back stairs to the upper parking lot where his driver was with the car, and his driver was gone. And I remember saying to him, "Where did your driver go?" And he said, "Oh, he had something else to do." And I remember thinking, how weird is that, you know?
Yeah, that the chauffeur had somewhere else to be when he's on Cosby's dime. Yeah, that's odd.
Right.
Yeah.
So Cosby said, "Well, I'll drive you girls home." And it was only a few blocks. So, you know, so I got in the back seat. She was in the front seat with him. And instead of turning right down onto the strip, he turned left up into the Hollywood Hills. And pretty soon, you know, he's swinging around corners and swerving, and my stomach is heaving, and I've got the spinners and
right.
I'm hunched over and I'm going, "Oh God, please let this be over soon so I can crawl into my bed." Well, he stopped and there we are in front of some building. It looked like a townhouse. And he said, "Oh, I want to show you girls my awards." And I'm going, "Oh God."
Right.
You know, last thing I care about are your damn awards. I just want to go home. And so I thought, well, maybe the two of them want to, you know, kind of get it on or something. So I'll just stay in the back seat of the car and wait, and they'll come back out and then we can go home. But instead, after he got her out, he opened the back door and he reached out and he pulled me out. We went upstairs two flights in an elevator. And when he opened the door, it wasn't an office. It was a little room with two love seats and a little writing desk and a fake French provincial phone and a little table light, a lamp. And she went directly over to the one against the wall, sat down and just keeled over and passed out. And I went to the one that was about 4 or 5 feet from the front door, parallel to the door, and sat down and put my head back. And I don't know whether I passed out or what, but then all of a sudden, everything was so silent, it woke me up.
Right.
And I looked around thinking they had left me. And instead, he was sitting next to her, looking down on her like some kind of a hawk. And you could see what was going on in his mind. It was just all over his face, plus his jeans were bulging. And I just thought, oh, my God. And she had a boyfriend. We each had boyfriends who we were living with. And so I just started thinking, my God. So I started reaching over the arm of the love seat and trying to, you know, but I couldn't make anything other than these guttural sounds, trying to distract him. And at first he ignored me. Then he started getting, you could see his expression. He was getting more and more irritated and aggravated with my distraction.
Right.
And finally he stood up and he was angry and he came towards me and his face was like a gargoyle. And I stood up because I had had an experience with my first husband of domestic abuse and I was fearful. But then my legs were like rubber and my legs started to collapse and I was trying to hold on to him so I didn't fall. Next thing I knew, he had me on my knees and he was sitting down with his fly open. And then he stood me up and turned me around and bent me forward. And then when he was finished, he started to just leave. And I remember saying, well, how are we going to get home? Garbling the words. And he wouldn't even look at me. He looked at the desk with the fake French provincial phone on it and said, call a cab. And then he slammed out of there. And I just got up and I staggered over to her and said, we've got to get out of here. We've got to get out of here. And we got up and we started to go, well, how are we going to call, you know, how are we going to call a cab? We don't know where we are. We don't have an address. And then we thought, well, maybe if we called home, maybe her boyfriend would have some kind of idea. He could figure it out because we just couldn't think clearly.
Right.
And so we went and picked up the phone and there was no dial tone. So she said, oh, well, maybe the cord is out of the jack. Mm-hmm. So she got down on her hands and knees and she crawls under the desk and there is no jack. And I pick up the cord only to discover that it's a prop phone. The cord is cut. Oh. One of those old cloth cords.
Right.
So we went, oh my God, so what are we going to do? And then we thought, well, we'll go out on the street. We'll try to figure out where we are. And we got to the elevator and then we had this panicky moment where we thought, what if the door opens and he's in it
right. And
we're trapped? So we looked for the stairwell and we, you know, teetered all the way downstairs, went out on the street and we were up in some windy little street and we could see the city lights below. And I don't know how late it was. It must've been after 10. And we started running downhill and she got down to the strip before I did and managed to hail a cab, which in itself was a miracle because you just don't hail cabs in LA, you know, it's not New York. So anyway, we climbed in the cab and got home. And when her boyfriend opened the door, we just sort of rushed through the door and blah, 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 whatever. I don't even know what we said. And he put his arm around her and they walked into their bedroom. And I went into my back bedroom, which was the same bedroom that I was in when I was taken home from the hospital when I was a newborn, and where my mom and I lived until she remarried. I was 3 and a half. Mm-hmm. So it was, you know, my comfort zone, you know. And so I never thought to even go to the police. I felt just, I mean, it was the last straw broken on an already broken woman's back, you know. And so I became very suicidal. Very depressed. She wanted to go over to the Figaro again one time. I didn't want to go, but I had the car. So finally I acquiesced. And I don't know how much longer after that happened that we went. She was going through the front door and I was dragging my feet, walking down the sidewalk. And all of a sudden, there were people on the street going, oh, look, there's Bill Cosby. And I went, oh, my God. And I was trying to decide, do I run back to the car or do I run in trying to catch her and grab her to go to the car? But either way, I was going to have to pass him.
Right.
So this big black limo pulls up to the curb. And I don't know what possessed me. I went up to the back window of the limo. And I looked in and I did one of these. But inside the limo was his wife.
Ooh, okay.
And him. And she looked absolutely so elegant, so beautiful. Her black hair pulled up in a beautiful chignon at the top of her head. And which made me feel even grubbier and more powerless. And just defeated. So I managed to walk away, go in there, and we found a little, she had found a little table tucked away someplace. We never even saw them come in to the restaurant. And then I was uncomfortable. And then after that, I was, you know, just very suicidal. And I decided I needed to get back to myself. Who was I anymore? You know, who had I ever been? Because I didn't, I'd lost myself entirely. And I remembered that the last time I ever remembered really being me or feeling like myself, feeling whole, was when I was a little girl crawling through the woods in Connecticut. Mm-hmm. And so I said, well, that's it. I've got to get back to nature, whatever it takes. So my music producer was the first guitar of Eric Burdon's group, The Animals. And he and his astrologer wife lived out in Topanga Canyon, about 45 minutes outside of LA.
Okay.
And it's a canyon where people like Neil Young and Bob Hurt and Linda Ronstadt, a lot of artists and musicians and alternative living people, thinking people lived, artists and craftsmen. And so they said, we'll get you a room in our neighbor's house. Come out here. And so I did. And at the end of that year, I had met this really crazy congressman's son who was a guitar picker and a songwriter. And he said, Vicky Blue, he said, I'm leaving for New Orleans. You coming with me? I love you. And I thought, nothing left to lose.
Right.
And so I did. And thank God, because it was his mother who saved my life, because she loved me unconditionally. Mm-hmm. And taught me all her good Cajun recipes. And I got six nieces out of the bargain that I crocheted for and wrote, sang my songs to.
Uh-huh.
Learned to cook a good gumbo. And so unfortunately, he was an alcoholic. And after 3 years, I wound up having to take our daughter, had a little beautiful girl who's turning 50 next month. And she's given me two wonderful grandsons. And I left. So I went up to Oregon and signed up for college, art history, ceramics, you know, things that really were healing and meditative. And over the years, I avoided talking about Cosby. Mm-hmm. I just tucked it away. Then in 1981, my aunt said, bring the kids down. I had another daughter by then. She said, come down and stay, and I'll take the kids to Disneyland.
Okay.
So 81, I came down to LA, and I thought, I think I'm going to call Meg. Her number was no longer in service, but I knew she was with William Morris Agency. Coincidentally, that is Cosby's agency.
Okay.
I didn't know that at the time. And I called them, left my name and number, and she called me back in about 5 minutes. And we started talking and catching up over whatever happened to each of us and blah, blah, blah. And as soon as I brought up that night, she shut me down. Boom. No, he's a wonderful man. He's a wonderful man. You're just being so negative. And the conversation was over. And I have never spoken to her since.
Okay.
So I tucked it away. I made references to what a schmuck he was over the years, but I never told anybody the dirty details, ever. I never in my mind ever really called it rape, because I just blamed myself for being stupid, for having taken the pill, for not fighting him off, for not having better survival skills or something. You know, somehow I just bought it all, bought the guilt. And 2005, I was heading out to work. I had a radio show that I was doing at Pasadena City College, and I was working as a registered nurse in an adult daycare center. And my youngest daughter, who was an adult by then, was living with me. And we had CNN on, and I'm rushing out the door, and all of a sudden, we hear Bill Cosby has been accused by a woman for drugging and fondling her, and I stopped dead.
Right.
And my daughter, who was standing there with her teacup, turned and looked at me, and we looked at each other, and I said, my God, that's a pattern. And she said, yeah, Mom, you should get in touch with that woman and lend your support. And I thought about it, but I didn't want to dredge up the past anymore. I just wanted to keep moving forward. You know, I didn't want to bring up anything negative. So every day I thought about it, but I couldn't do it. So then years go by, his son is murdered. And I went, oh my God. Now he knows what it's like to lose your only son.
Right.
And I thought, karma. And I wrote a little short story about it. I didn't have it published, but I mentioned it to this other playmate who was doing, she was writing a book or something, or wanted to do a video on playmate memories.
Okay.
But the story I wrote was just about that. I called him Mr. Comedian. I never mentioned his name. I never discussed the details of what happened. But just that karma had come back to bite him in the butt.
Right.
And then after that, it was over. So then the end of 2014 comes up. And it's November 21st, late at night, and I'm getting ready to go to bed. I'm checking my email, and I see this story on Yahoo, this woman named Barbara Bowman, who was saying that she had been trying to be believed about Cosby drugging and raping her for 35 years and nobody believed her. And even at that point, I said, I don't want to know anything about it. Go away, get out of my consciousness. I'm doing positive things. I just can't go back into that place anymore. But just after that, as I'm getting ready to shut down, all of a sudden, Hannibal Buress calls Cosby a rapist in his stand-up routine in a nightclub in Philadelphia. And I just stopped dead and I didn't shut it off, shut the computer down. And I watched his routine and it was like, come on, black folk. You know, he's quoting Cosby in his stand-up routine. Come on, black folk, pull your pants up, you know. And he's giving them some kind of moral guidance.
Right.
And Hannibal Buress is saying, who the hell are you to talk? Come on, Cosby, everybody knows you're just a rapist. Whoa. Suddenly it was like this little, I don't know, explosion, you know, this red rocket of anger just started in my gut and just shot up like fireworks into my brain and blew up. And I went, oh, that's it. You know, it was like, that was my tipping point. And so I started thinking, who do I know? Who do I, you know, who can I talk to? And of course, we were always going to the Playboy Mansion for the big parties. So, in the 90s, I knew a lot of people associated with Hef and journalists and megastars and this and that. So I tried to get in touch with a journalist who I knew worked for People magazine. And that was it. I waited, went to bed. My brain was whirling with all of these thoughts suddenly, and woke up in the morning, raced over to the computer to see if I had gotten an answer. Nothing from People magazine, from this journalist. And then I went back and I thought, who did Barbara Bowman speak to? Who wrote her story? It turned out it was the Washington Post. So I went on the Washington Post website and I'm looking for the little comment box.
Right.
You know, and thinking, I'm just going to say it. You know, I was drugged and raped by Bill Cosby in 1969. And not really ever expecting to get an answer. And within the hour, I got a call from Adam Kushner, the executive editor. And he, from that moment forward, there was no turning back. And so I came out in the Washington Post and they told me, you know, there are going to be a lot of media calling you once this hits the stands.
Right.
We can field all those calls or you can take them. And I thought at that point, it was like suddenly everything started rushing out of me, you know, that I had stuffed all those years, was just like pouring out of me. My brain was exploding. Everything was just, you know. And so I said, in for a penny, in for a pound, you know, yeah. Send them my way.
Right.
And from that moment forward, it was like nonstop interviews. Nonstop interviews in every major media show, CNN, New Day, Inside Edition, you know, everything, Don Lemon, you know, and they were flying me back and forth to New York, and Inside Edition was sending cars to take me out to their studio in Culver City. And I mean, it just suddenly became this explosion of women coming out of the woodwork. And every show I did, the Dr. Phil show, Don Lemon special, I was meeting more and more women who had had almost identical experiences with Bill Cosby,
right,
except
right.
you know, it was like variations, but always the same theme. And we started forming this circle of the sisterhood.
Okay.
The circle of sisters and sharing information and having support groups and comforting each other and experiences and you know, and then other people who were caught up in the story were collecting data. Brandy Betts, who would do a spreadsheet, you know, and put every woman's information on a spreadsheet, the time, the date, the experience and the symptoms, his symptoms, and what he was doing in his life as our careers were being derailed, as we were suffering PTSD, his star was climbing.
Right. And that, yeah. So it's interesting. And because I was doing the math when you were telling me, so it's been 53 years since the incident.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever think that it would ever come out, that you would be able to tell your story and people were listening or would listen, or were you afraid that you were going to keep it with you for the rest of your life?
It never occurred to me that I would ever talk about it and certainly not use his name because I was afraid.
Okay.
One of not being believed, but afraid of repercussions by him, because by that time, he was one of the most powerful men in show business, practically owned NBC, practically owned William Morris Agency. And who am I?
Right. Oh, I understand.
You know, because I think it's believe me.
Yeah, because I think it's interesting that because there's power in numbers with all these women coming out, being able to do this. Now, the one thing that surprised me, because I'm also in the state of Pennsylvania, where the trial happened in Montgomery County.
And I was there. I was there at both trials and the sentencing. Too bad you didn't let me know where you were. We could have, I could have had you brought you into the trial.
That would have been interesting. But the thing that gets me is there's still people out there that believe that he couldn't do this. There's people.
Oh, there's a whole Twitter thread called Bill Cosby is innocent. And some of the horrific things that they say about us is so damaging. I mean, we have had, not from those particular people, but we've had death threats. We're called gold diggers. We're called liars. We're called, you know, one of our sisters was spat upon.
Oh.
You know, I can't even begin to tell you.
But the thing I don't understand, and I think the people need to understand, is you were not trying to get financial gain. You were just trying to tell you, because it was too long, but you were just trying to get it out there.
Truth and justice, man.
Yeah. To get it out to people, to make them understand, hey, this is what this guy did. He's not America's dad the way they made him appear on TV. Nope. Because again, he was everywhere, and that's what it was supposed to look like. Now, since the whole thing broke in 2014, what have you been doing with your advocacy that you are doing for victims of rape and violence and domestic abuse?
Well, initially, it was just me feeling like, my God, I finally said it, you know, I finally said it. And I'm networking with all these other women and we're supporting each other and the truth is finally coming out and maybe there'll be justice.
Right.
Not for us, only vicariously through Andrea Constant, who was the only one of us who was still within the statute of limitations, you know. So it wasn't until probably early spring of 2016. And I'd done tons of shows by then and networked, met so many women. By that time, there were like 62 women who came forward. We had done the New York Magazine empty chair cover, which blew the lid off.
I remember that, yeah.
And NBC Dateline, there were 27 of us on that show. I mean, it was just mushrooming, the knowledge, the experiences, and the vast reach of damage that he had created amongst so many women in their lives. One of my sisters was so afraid and so physically damaged by him, she left and moved to Spain. So finally, that summer, a friend of mine who had been the director of women's issues in Sacramento called me and told me that there was a group that was going to be meeting in West Hollywood, a group that was being organized by one of the original founders of the National Organization for Women, a woman named Ivy Bettini, who was, I think at that point, in her late 80s and practically blind and walked with a cane and needed a caregiver. But she was so passionate about finding truth in all of this and getting justice for us that she recognized that there needed to be a change in the laws. Because the statute of limitations in California alone, and it's different in each state, the statute of limitations in California was only 10 years. And what people don't understand about post-rape behavior and symptomology is that a lot of times, as in my case, you can't talk about it. How many decades went by before I was able to even just say the words, to say the word rape, to right. call it by its name. And so in order for justice to be achieved, the statute of limitations had to be expanded or abolished. So we started meeting at the Jewish Women's Center on North Fairfax in West Hollywood once a week. We started making t-shirts with the no sign mm-hmm. SOL. And we started speaking out. We started speaking. We rallied on Hollywood Boulevard on Cosby's Star. One of the women who was in our meeting knew a couple of senators. One of them was Kamala Harris, by the way, our vice president, and she was a California senator at the time. And the senator that she reached first was from San Bernardino County, Senator Connie Leyva. And she convinced her to write this bill called the Justice for Victims Act, SB 813.
Okay.
And so once the bill was written, we had to go up to Sacramento, our group, members of our coalition. And so we would carpool. I would go up with Lily Bernard, who was one of Cosby's survivors. She's an Afro-Cuban muralist with six children, and who is also at this point now suing him because in New Jersey, where he raped her in Atlantic City, the laws have changed with the statute of limitations. And so now she is able to file suit against him in New Jersey.
Oh, wow. Okay.
She had him on tape threatening her. And because she was just a couple of months out of the statute of limitations, she couldn't do anything about it. So now she can. So, you know, things are changing. So anyway, so we kept carpooling up. We were testifying in front of the Senate Committee on Public Safety. My testimony is in Gloria Allred's documentary of her life story called Seeing All Red.
Okay.
We lobbied. We walked from office to office all through the state capitol. We rallied on the state capitol steps. We interviewed for every media outlet that would give us airtime, and we just went for it, you know. So one particular amazing moment, we were testifying in front of the West Hollywood City Council, where I had been raped the end of 69.
Right.
By Cosby. And And we testified, we got a yay, unanimous yay vote to move forward. And as I'm leaving the assembly hall and going out into the lobby, where there are big screen TVs, where everybody in the lobby could see what was transpiring at the front of the, you know, the city council meeting, there was this sheriff standing there, a woman sheriff in her beige outfit, packing a gun. And as I walked out, I started to go past her, and she just looked at me, put her hand out. And I looked at her, and she had this little smile on her face, trying to act stoic and professional. Right. And I just said, and I took her hand to shake it, and I said, I'd really like to give you a hug, but I don't know if that's acceptable, you know. And she threw her arms around me, and we stood there, and we hugged, and we rocked. And it was the most healing moment. You know, like the circle had come around, you know.
Right.
It was unbelievable.
Now, when I look back, and again, they threw out the case in Pennsylvania because mm-hmm. there was supposedly a deal made that he could not be prosecuted. And again, I still think that this was money that bought him off. I don't care what anybody says. If you have the most money, you're going to win no matter what happens. And he walks free. He walks out. Yes, I understand he's old. I understand he's ill, but he doesn't have to pay for the crimes he's committed. And that's the thing that had to be deflating to you and the group that were put together because of him, because all of a sudden he walks out the door and people are saying, well, he got off free. So in other words, it must not have happened.
Well, what happened was, and it was absolutely beyond deflating. The legal system ripped the rug out from under us, vacated his entire sentence, vacated all of our testimonies, all of our stories, and he is no longer registered as a violent sexual predator.
Which amazes
me. Yeah, but now here's the backstory. The prior, the former DA, Bruce Castor, who also testified for Trump's acquittal.
Yes.
You know, bumbled around like a fool.
Yes.
There. And he, as it turns out, his father was the realtor that helped Cosby get his Cheltenham mansion.
Oh, okay.
In Montgomery County, Pennsylvania.
Right.
So you don't think there was something going on there?
Oh, I'm sure.
No. So again, there was nothing written down on paper that there was an agreement made that if Cosby told the truth on camera, I mean, on tape, under oath, that he would no longer be prosecuted. And that's what Bruce Castor was saying, that, well, I promised him that if he told the truth under oath, that I wouldn't prosecute him. But there was nothing written down, no agreement in writing. And as you know, if it's not in writing, it's not worth the paper it's written on. So nevertheless, we all heard, and the jury heard in court,
right,
Cosby admitting that he bought drugs to give to women to have sex with them. In court, we heard that. His voice, he admitted it.
I'm honestly surprised that no one has taken that testimony that was recorded and mm-hmm. put it on a video loop on a website, just having it go over and over again.
Oh, because, I would so love that, man. Because I would blast it out of the front door of my house, you know?
Because the woman you said in Atlantic City, she now has him admitting to what he did. And if she does file, there's no way she can lose, in my opinion.
Well, I would certainly hope so, because she has been through hell.
Right.
And she's a brilliant actress, a brilliant painter. She was a guest on his show. And she and I did a lot of media together, probably because we both lived in LA. We were both pretty. We both were a good contrast. She, the Afro-Cuban, young enough to be my daughter, you know, with her big, beautiful hair, and me, the old blonde, you know. And so they could easily access us. And we were both articulate. I mean, she's got a master's degree. I mean, she's a brilliant woman. And you know, so we did a lot of media together. And I know from years of being close to her, the damage that this has done to her. I know. I can't tell you what I know because I don't want to betray that.
Right.
You know, for her sake. And you know, it was just unbelievable. But now Kevin Steele, the DA that prosecuted him and got him convicted, who is just this kind of Jimmy Stewart kind of guy, mm-hmm. you know, his closing arguments were so kind of slow and laid back, like he's just riding a slow horse with his chaps and his, right. you know, and then I wanted to jump in and do it myself. You know, I was like, come on. And then all of a sudden, without warning, he'd kind of slip it in from the side, you know, get it between the ribs and, you know, zoom, you know. It was, I mean, he was brilliant. But anyway, he is working right now on re-prosecuting.
Okay.
But the reason this came about, Cosby getting out, this decision was December 1st last year. Cosby won an appeal hearing, finally. He'd been trying for some time and finally achieved an appeal hearing. And I was in North Carolina with my kids packing to head to the airport in Greensboro. So I'm watching it on my phone on Zoom. And even at that point, one of the justices triggered my predator little intuitive signal, a guy, old man, white hair. And I just went, you know, and the woman justice, she says, well, I just don't see a pattern here. And we're going, what? You don't see a pattern? Everybody in the whole freaking world sees a pattern.
Yeah.
Including the jury, including the judge, including everybody except for the people who managed to get to the line in front of the courthouse before 7 a.m, the Cosby apologists who, you know, were bringing pictures to be autographed by him when he walked in. You know, I mean, it was unbelievable. What a circus.
Now, the other thing is, too, is that why, and I don't know if you would be able or not, did you not file a civil suit against him?
Well, I have my statute of limitations was way
on a civil
expired.
Suit. Though.
There's nothing I can do about it. He hasn't done anything. He has not personally, or any of his entourage, personally said anything in public to discredit me.
Okay.
Some of the women who had a libel suit against him. Because they, his wife, I think, they had accused him of being liars.
Okay.
But that happened the day before I went public.
Oh, okay.
So I couldn't even be part of that suit, that libel suit. However, had I been, my lips would have been zipped. I wouldn't have been able to go public and talk about it. You see, and frankly, that's a good thing because even though I didn't get money out of the whole deal, that wasn't, I mean, I practically bankrupted myself going public and being where I needed to be to speak because it was so important. Because if I had gone with that suit, I would not have been able to be in front of the camera talking about it all the time.
Oh,
that's,
yeah, I got you. Yeah.
And that was what my role was apparently. Universally, karmically, whatever. Right. I had to be that voice.
Now, the one thing I find interesting, and I'm pulling up, I've pulled up old stories, And the people that were supporting him, like Felicia Rashad, they were all acting like he was the victim. And I'm thinking, and now, because I guess Howard University pulled her honorary degree or whatever it was, and he comes out bashing him and saying it's the mainstream media. And I'm thinking, no, he's a bad man, did bad things, and he needs to take responsibility. Even though she made millions because of him, that doesn't mean she has to support him. The funny thing is, the rest of the cast, you haven't seen hide nor hair of them in years, especially when his name comes up in conversation.
Nicole Rochelle, she was one of the children actors on that series. Now, he didn't rape her, as far as I know. She was the person in front of the courthouse who jumped out topless on the walkway as they were walking him on the sidewalk. She had all of our names written on her torso.
I just pulled up the photograph. I see it right here. Yeah.
And you'll see Victoria is written right here. Well, she lives in France right now. She's an actress and an amazing singer. And she wrote a song. I wish I could remember the name of it, but it's Just Call Me Bill, you know? Mm-hmm. And it was a hip hop, but it was an incredibly brilliant song and the lyrics were incredible. But right after that, she was in Paris and had her baby prematurely and little Lawrence who died. Mm-hmm. And now she has another child, a little girl who lived. And but she and her husband and her baby, they live in France. And but she knew, everybody knew. They knew something was going on. I have a friend, guy named Tommy Lightfoot Garrett.
Okay.
He worked for HBO. I think he currently works for HBO, but he had a Hollywood Highlight or Highlight Hollywood journal, online journal. And he was raised in a very wealthy Black family in Bel Air. And he said that when he was growing up, he had been warned by Betty Davis and Barbara Stanwyck about the Cosbys.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Don't go to their house and take anything from them. Not him, them.
Them. Interesting.
And he told me, he said, it used to be the joke that when the Cosbys would have a party, all the kids who were invited up to the party would always stop and get drunk before they would get there and eat before they got there. Because it was well known. Everybody knew what they did.
I'll share the picture, the Nicole's photograph. You're right. You're right here along the neckline and it says women and then it blurs everything out from like, but there it is right there.
Yeah, so. And the cop, Carl, who always was seen walking right behind Cosby when he was walking into the courthouse, He was the one who got her under control. And I thanked him because he didn't taser her. Mm-hmm. You know, he pushed her. It looked like she was coming out of the hedge, but He was actually pushing her back into the hedge and getting her out of the walkway. And he was great. He was also the one who, because I got stuck out in the hallway coming in from a break when the jury was going in to read out the verdict. And I got stuck out in the hallway with this crowd of people from the courthouse. And I was so upset. I thought, all of this time and I can't be in there when they're reading the verdict. You know, it was just insane. And so anyway, so Carl, this wonderful cop, he texted out guilty, guilty, guilty. And we were out in the hallway going, wah! You know, but he was a great guy. And I thanked him. I said, thank you for not tasering her because that would have just been awful.
Right.
And he said, well, it would have been inappropriate.
Yeah. And of course, and that would have been the story. That would have been the focal point because the news media was there and saw it. And then, do you ever think you will see the day that he actually gets sentenced again? Or do you think it's just going to go away because of his age?
I don't know. I mean, I hope. I hope he winds up being put back in prison. Gloria Allred, who is just an amazing woman, no matter what other male attorneys say about her.
Right.
She knows how to work the media so people get the story and it doesn't get swept under the rug. I mean, she is one strong woman's advocate. She was raped at gunpoint in Mexico.
Oh, wow. I didn't realize that.
Yeah. So, I mean, she's not just talking off the top of her head. Right. She's been there. She knows. So anyway, Gloria has a civil suit against him currently because he took a 15-year-old girl, Judy Huth, to the Playboy Mansion and drugged and raped her there. And so Gloria will depose him. He has no choice but to be deposed by her at this point. So, you know, justice is going to come one way or the other.
Do we know when that's going to happen, or has there not been a date set?
I don't know. I haven't spoken to Gloria for a while yet, so I don't know. And I haven't heard her mentioning it in any of our groups, so I don't know.
Because I think, especially with him, because he became the face of this behavior. And people, when they see him, that's the first thing they think of. They don't think of anything else anymore. And that has, no matter if he would ever be able to get a career back again, he would never have one. But that's the first thing people see. That's the first thing people think of. But yet you would assume that other people in the spotlight would realize that because of what happened to him, they should not do this anymore. We have a former president who was accused by how many women and nothing happened.
Right.
I don't understand why these men are able to get away with it. And I know it has a lot to do with the money they have and the power and the influence. But eventually you would assume the court system would catch up with them.
Look, when you have enough money, you can afford to pay for a hermetically sealed chrysalis around you.
Right.
And what Tommy Lee Garrett told me, Lightfoot Garrett told me, not Tommy Lee, he told me that, well, now I've forgotten. That happens at my age. Just went whoop, right out the window. He told me that there were careers made of guys by Cosby for supplying him with an endless supply of women that he could drug and rape. And the thing with Cosby is he can never have sex with a woman with her face. He can't have them look at him, or he can't look at them.
Right.
And even one of our sister survivors, Beth Ferrier Tillo, said that, and she had had a consensual relationship with him. They broke up. And then when they made up again, that was when he drugged and raped her. And she said that even when they had a consensual relationship, he always had to do it doggy style or with her face turning away. There's something, some brain glitch that he's got going on.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And I've noticed, and just listening to you talk about the one friend that you were with when the incident happened, is that she basically denied what happened. So were there other women out there that were still enabling him and trying to justify what he did?
Well, I suppose if they think they're going to be making book, you know, on some level, if they're going to get starring roles in something. As it turned out, she wound up getting a guest spot on his show in 1986.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Now, I only found out about that a couple of years ago. But when I went public, the Washington Post tried to vet me, of course.
Right.
And she was the witness. Well, she wasn't really a witness because she was unconscious.
Right.
But they contacted her, got her telephone number, called. She never answered any of the calls. And then ultimately, William Morris reached out to the Washington Post and said, "We have decided not to comment on this issue." Now, the journalist, Scott Higham, who wrote my story along with Manuel Roig Francia, said to me, "That's more damaging than if they had just simply said no comment."
Right.
Or we don't know what the F you're talking about.
Right.
Yeah. So, you know, I think the thing now is that we have to just get out of this rut. You know, we're spinning our wheels right now and we're worrying about him.
Right.
Whatever's going to happen with him is going to happen with him. The fact is, what is happening with us is that we have found our voices. We opened the floodgates for the Me Too movement to take the fore. Now, the Me Too movement had been there all along, but it really hadn't taken the front row of in front of the cameras.
It did so, become on the mindset of America, yeah.
But interestingly enough, Oprah, who is supposedly supportive of women, never went public in support of us.
Interesting.
And we all wondered about that. However, come the Oscars, after the Weinstein women found courage because of us.
Right.
Because they realized that we had spoken our truth. We were not decapitated in the village square.
Right.
We were not eviscerated. And yet, you know, Oprah still didn't speak out. So the Weinstein women then have courage. They come out against Harvey Weinstein. And then suddenly the Oscars, and Oprah stands up and gives this incredibly moving, deep, powerful speech. Why didn't she come out for us?
Well,
because she and Camille Cosby were best friends.
That's what I was just going to say. Yeah.
Ta-da!
Yeah. I mean, that is really, I can't believe that. Wrong is wrong, no matter who you're friends with.
Yeah.
And if you have a voice like that, you come out on the side of right. But again, she kept her mouth shut. And I'm surprised, again, that no one's really said anything more about that, because to expose her as being two-faced, I mean, it's just very interesting. What's that?
She participated.
Well, yeah. And again, she probably had
his personal manager. She knew where every penny went. Plus, one of my neighbors, who was a chanteuse from Montreal, woke up in the middle of the drugging, and Mrs. was part of the little orgy.
That is, again.
And she is too terrified to ever speak out about it.
Because what is she afraid is going to happen?
Well, there is nobody else who has mentioned it. So she has no corroboration.
Oh, okay.
But I
get Camille, but again, Oprah being this women's advocate that she claims she is, and then not saying anything, it makes it look like she has a tie to Cosby himself other than Camille.
Well, maybe she does.
Right.
When I was trafficked by my first husband after my centerfold hit the stands.
Yeah.
I experienced stuff that no 21-year-old little girl from Connecticut should ever experience. But I can tell you that there were a lot of couples that would hire people.
Right.
Women. So it does not surprise me. You know, I saw the slimy underbelly of so many megastars who are still held up on pedestals to this day.
Right. I gotcha.
But I know how much they charged and I know all their fetishes.
Oh.
And, you know, so what do you, you know, yeah. what does a kid do with that? You know, here I am 79 and I look back on that and I think, why didn't I ever move forward? All I ever wanted to do as a kid was sing and dance on Broadway, and somehow I wound up in LA.
Right.
And, you know, and I was a good actress. I was trained actress. And yet, after what happened to me, I was afraid to really push myself in show business. I was afraid I was going to cross paths with some of those people.
Oh, well, that makes a lot of sense. I can understand why.
And I didn't want to be recognized.
Right.
And I was fearful. And I also had lost the apple had lost its shine.
Right.
And suddenly it was like, I don't want to be part of that. Yeah. That's not who I am. I don't want to be in that. You know, it was just, you know, it just grossed me out.
I mean, it just amazes me that this was going on and probably still going on per se. And it hasn't, and no one has stopped it, because it is just, I mean, we've always heard the stories of the casting couch. We've always heard that. But what you're saying and being trafficked out, being drugged and everything else, I mean, that is just unheard of in my mind in where I'm at, which again, it probably happens more places than not. It's just, it's not hitting the news every night.
Well, I'm sure it's happening as we speak.
Yeah.
You know, I think every 8 seconds a woman is being raped. And look at these poor women now in Afghanistan, which just totally breaks my heart. These little children starving, the women who were on their way to a degree.
Right.
You know, now are shrouded in these blue, in chadri, you know, in these burqas and have no life. Because after all, what are women for? Right.
Right.
We're just here to be punches for, you know, ignorant sons of bitches who have no imagination or have no self-control or whatever, you know. I mean, we're just vehicles for receptacles.
Right.
And yeah. Incubators.
Yeah. Again, and again, I don't know. I have a daughter who is in her teenage years, and I feel that I've always been this way concerning these issues, but I've noticed that the older she gets, the more adamant I've become. And I just think that if you have a daughter, or if you have a mother that you love, or a sister, whatever it is, how can you stand there and let this happen? Especially those people that are in power in the legislature, in Congress, in the Senate. You and I were talking a while back about the Equal Amendment, that it's only been ratified in how many states?
I think it's 38 or 39 states.
There's 50 states in the union, and we still haven't had an Equal Rights Amendment.
Yeah, and stop it. Listen to this. I mean, okay, my male cousin, whose diapers I changed.
Right.
We have the same ancestral roots. Our ancestors fought in the Revolutionary War.
Right.
Our ancestors were here from 1732. I have it written down in the Bible.
Uh-huh.
And yet he's equal under the Constitution in any state he decides to go to. But I am not. Now, how is that just?
It just doesn't make sense to me. That we live in this male society that degrades other human beings, especially women, who honestly I think are better off and more intelligent and more rational than most guys that I know. I know I'm married to one. I've been married for 25 years, and I know that if it wasn't for her, I probably still wouldn't be here. Because
they say
that
men live longer if they're married.
Right. So again, it just amazes me that we have people that are that, do you want to call them stupid? Do you want to call them ignorant? What do you want to call them? That still think that we go back to 200, that women are property. I don't get it. I would figure by now it would all be equal.
which is why the only male I am owned by at this point in time is my Chihuahua and my orange tabby cat, who wakes me up whether I want to get up or not.
Right.
At 7 o'clock on the dot. And I'm going, leave me alone, leave me alone. And I'm thinking, husband, orange cat. You know, it's almost the same.
I get it.
Yeah.
But again, it just... What society, I would figure I'm in my mid-50s now, and I thought that it would get better the older I got. And what I'm seeing when it comes to the way people are treated, it's getting worse. And how do you fix that? How do you get through it? I know that sometimes it has to be crushing to you that things that you try to get past or people you work with or talk with are not succeeding the way they should be because of the post-traumatic stress.
You know, after Cosby got out of prison, it was like nonstop interviews every day. And then I took a red eye on a Friday night and arrived in Philly on the Saturday. And we had a vigil in Independence Square. And I gave a speech. It was spontaneous. And I just pretty much rambled. I didn't tie it up the way I wanted to, but my point having been that my legacy will wind up, the things that I will be remembered for are my tits and ass, essentially, from Playboy, and being raped by Bill Cosby. Not the songs that I have written, not the patients who I made comfortable as they transitioned into the next plane, not the acting parts that I ever did when I played Saint Joan of Arc when I was 17 and lost myself in the part to the point where I became and wound up on my knees in tears at the end of her monologue, you know, when she was committing herself essentially to the flames rather than admit that she was wrong and be in a dungeon for the rest of her life away from riding her horse in nature and hearing her angel voices.
Right.
You know, none of those things will ever be known about me, really, except I'm going to talk about them anyway, and I'm going to write them in my book.
Right.
But, you know, I was just one of so many of his victims. And I think of the talent. I think of Lily Bernard's incredible talent. And I think of every single woman that I have met through this journey who is so talented. And yet, that won't be what they will be remembered for.
Right.
They will not have been able to fulfill their profession, their gift, the world will not have been able to be graced with their gifts because he damaged us to the point where our careers were derailed while his star soared. And I think of all of those women and their talents and their beauty and their spiritual gifts that the world will never have a chance to be graced with.
Right. And again, when you think about it, not only with his victims, but with every victim that we're dealing with, it's just unbelievable that somebody thinks that they have the power to take away something from someone else. And it just, to me, it just angers me the more I talk about it, which probably is a good thing. But again, I just don't get it. I really don't understand why people feel that they have to be in control of everybody, but yet they can't be in control of themselves.
But you see, they have malignant narcissism, which comes from a deep place of unworthiness. Mm-hmm. It's like this black hole where everything gets sucked into it. You know, no matter how much we would be praising, no matter how many accolades, no matter how much money he's making, you know, any of these people. Trump is another one who has the same diagnosis.
Yes.
And the people who are still, you know,
bowing to him. Yes,
bowing to this madman who they're sociopaths. You see, and people who have a moral compass, people who are naturally empathic, people who have a conscience, mm-hmm. it is inconceivable for them to imagine anybody who has none.
Right. Oh, yeah.
And so that's why we, the empaths, the ones who are conscience ridden, it is, that's why we become victimized by these people, because we always try to see the good side of that person. And so we keep giving and trying to help them and trying to support them and, you know, and feel bad because they had a troubled childhood or, you know, all of that stuff.
Right.
Because we're the compassionate ones.
Right.
And they're sucking it in.
Yeah.
And they're like a bucket with a hole in it. We keep pouring in the water and they're still empty, and they will take all we've got to give until we have nothing left to give. No more juice.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then they'll kick us to the curb and go on to the next person who has juice.
Yeah.
And they'll use them up, kick them to the curb. That's what Trump is doing. That's what Cosby did. And that's what so many other of these megalomaniacs will do. And there will always be somebody who looks at them and, you know, like the evangelist in the tent, you know, the Jim Joneses.
Yes.
The David Koresh's.
Yes.
You see, that is that same malignant narcissist. That is that diagnosis. And I've worked a lot towards, so I know, mm-hmm. you know, that these people, they, you know, they're grandiose. You know, they think they are so fabulous. And if they have been medicated for their bipolar or for, you know, their schizophrenia or whatever, you know, they think after a period of time that they don't need it because they start feeling normal.
Right.
But they also miss the energy that they got from their insanity. Mm-hmm. And they want the color and the vibrancy that that gave them.
Right.
And so they go off their meds, and the meds are still in the system for a few days. And so they're thinking, I'm okay. And then all of a sudden they start decompensating and they wind up having a psychotic break. And guess what? They're in the window with a shotgun holding their wife and kids hostage.
Yeah.
You know, and then they wind up being thrown in the locked ward.
Right. Exactly. Victoria, thank you very much. I mean, it was nice to talk to you. I can't say it was a pleasure to relive everything you've been through.
You and I
have been talking on and off since the last interview, and I really am glad that I've gotten to meet you, maybe
thank
not
you.
In person, but this way, because of the, I think we've developed a friendship here. And
yes, we have.
And the next time, or if anything comes up that you want to talk about, please let me know. We'll get you back on again. And it's been a pleasure. I'm still looking. I'm waiting for the book. I'm waiting for you to actually get that done.
I need an editor. But let me put in a little pitch for Kamau Bell,
okay.
who has a 4-part Showtime series, who was going to be at the Sundance Festival. I was interviewed. It's called We Need to Talk About Cosby.
Okay.
And we are now online, and the premiere will be on January 30th. And I am also in the process of having a website designed, and I will let you know when it launches.
Well, that sounds great.
I will be open to speaking with people directly if they want to, you know, touch bases.
Well, Victoria, thank you very much. I greatly appreciate it. And we'll talk to you next time.
Thank you so much, Bill. Thank you for having me.
Hey, a big thank you goes out to Victoria Valentina for joining me today. Victoria, thanks very much for talking to us, and can't wait to talk to you next time. Well, that's going to wrap it up for yours truly, Bill Alexander. For all of you watching and listening, you have a great day. We'll talk to you next time.
Thank you for listening to One-on-One with Bill Alexander. One-on-One with Bill Alexander is a $1 Million Baby production. For more information, go to BillAlexander.net.